This is the NPR News Update for Friday, April 12th. News on your schedule. I'm Curry Vanelli. University of Minnesota researchers today present their findings on 5 years' worth of study of health issues in Minnesota taconite mines. Mayo Clinic's complicated tax financing plan, aimed at delivering $500 million of taxpayer money to Rochester, is being dropped for another proposal. The Minnesota Senate will consider an expansion of the state sales tax as part of their proposed budget fix this session. And a new movie about the Duluth-based band Low will premiere tonight at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival. University of Minnesota researchers are on the Iron Range today, sharing findings of their study into possible links between asbestos exposure in taconite mines and a deadly disease called mesothelioma. 80 former Minnesota miners have died from the rare cancer, which attacks the lining of the lungs. That's a much higher number than would be expected. For the past 5 years, researchers have been trying to figure out whether exposure to dust in the mines and processing plants makes workers more vulnerable, not only to mesothelioma, but to other respiratory diseases. Stephanie Hempel and Dan Crocker have our report.
It's afternoon in Aurora on the eastern edge of the Iron Range, but 77-year-old Gene Olds is still in his pajamas. A long oxygen tube loops over his ears to his nose. Olds needs the oxygen 24 hours a day.
It's something I don't wish on anyone. I just don't. It's hard on my family. It's hard on me. I can't do the things I always wanted to do.
Olds worked as a millwright at the LTV Steel Taconite plant in nearby Hoyt Lakes for 38 years until he retired in 1996. Soon after, he was diagnosed with asbestosis, a scarring of the lung tissue caused by inhaling asbestos fibers. Both he and his former LTV co-worker, Dave Trock, remember extremely dusty working conditions.
When I was a crane operator, and in the summertime when they pulled those doors back, then the sunlight came in, it was just full of dust.
It was pathetic. It was just pathetic. You could look and see that fine dust mist in the air. It was just terrible.
But Old says it was also a good job.
You know, it was a good wage. I wasn't going to let my family down. But at the time, we didn't know.
They didn't tell us, you know?
We didn't know.
They didn't tell us. This is what makes me so mad. Gino used to be pretty athletic and full of life, and look what it's done to him.
Both Dave Trock and Gene Olds are convinced that breathing in that dust caused Olds and hundreds more miners to get sick with asbestosis, lung cancer, and mesothelioma, a rare cancer of the lung lining that's only caused by asbestos. The two men hope that today, when the results from the five-year-long University of Minnesota study are released, they'll finally learn what exactly has caused at least some of those diseases to be so much more prevalent on the Iron Range. The deaths of those 80 former mine workers from mesothelioma represent about twice the expected rate in Minnesota, and the incidence of lung cancer is also higher. But for Dave Trock, the statistics aren't what's important.
When we talk about people dying from this stuff, it's faces that come to our mind.
Oh, yeah.
It's people we worked with, you know, and we've lost a lot of guys that had passed away from this asbestos or asbestos-like fiber.
I'm Stephanie Hemphill. No one knows for sure what's caused all this illness, but there is some evidence. In 1973, fibers similar to asbestos were found in the Duluth water supply and traced to waste rock dumped into Lake Superior by the Reserve Mining Company in Silver Bay. In the 1980s, a radiologist on the Iron Range reported unusual numbers of lung abnormalities in his patients' x-rays. In 1999, the Minnesota Department of Health confirmed a much higher rate of mesothelioma among men in northeastern Minnesota. A 2003 Health Department study concluded the most likely cause was the commercial asbestos used in various parts of the taconite production process. Many mine workers, including Gene Olds, handled commercial asbestos regularly in their work. That doesn't happen anymore in modern taconite facilities. But skeptics pointed to the asbestos-like particles in the Silver Bay waste rock and wanted wanted to know whether those fibers occur in iron ore all across the range and might be causing the mesothelioma and the other diseases. The current study may not answer that question definitively. Dr. Jeffrey Mandel from the U's School of Public Health is overseeing the research. He says his team has no measurements of dust from commercial asbestos because it's not used so much anymore. They concentrated instead on dust produced by crushing and handling the taconite ore.
That's the one that we can do a better job of estimating the exposures to, and realizing that the commercial asbestos may be playing a role here, but it's really hard to control for that in any of our work.
Trust is a major issue for Iron Range workers and their families. Some mining companies occasionally took x-rays of workers, but some of those workers wonder whether the companies were completely forthcoming in sharing the results. In 2007, the State Health Department withheld information on newly identified mesothelioma deaths for a year while it designed follow-up studies. Iron Range residents, including then-Representative Tom Rukavina, were furious.
For some reason, they hit it. We were all outraged. I've never figured out why the Pawlenty administration, you know, hid that information. And in 2007... We demanded some answers.
The state legislature allocated $4.9 million and directed the University of Minnesota to take over the research. It turned into a huge project involving health screening for retired and current mine workers, the dust measurements both inside and outside the plants, comparisons of death rates for various diseases among miners versus the general population, and assessment of risks for various respiratory diseases for taconite workers. This time, researchers were careful to keep interested people up to date. They held regular meetings on the Iron Range to share progress and results. Range workers not only have much higher rates of the extremely rare mesothelioma, they also have higher rates of lung cancer and heart disease. Surprisingly, rates of other respiratory diseases are comparable to the general population.
The study comes too late for some retirees on the Iron Range, like Bill Stadola. The 74-year-old worked at LTV Steel until the company went bankrupt in 2001. His wife Mary says he was diagnosed with asbestosis a decade ago and worries about getting mesothelioma.
It's too late for people that are sick. I mean, no money amount is going to help you, but we need, if there's a problem, just protect it to save our younger generations. So that's what our goal is.
And some things have changed on the range. Gene Old says his son-in-law, who also worked at LTV but now works at MinTac, the largest taconite facility on the range, tells him it's different now than it used to be.
Totally different. They demand that you wear a face mask all the time. All the time.
In an interim report on its research, the U of M researchers have found that dust levels in the processing plants now are mostly within federal guidelines. But as so often happens in scientific research, the study raises a new question. Are those federal guidelines addressing the right problem? Research Director Jeffrey Mandel says most of the fibers in the processing plants, called elongated mineral particles, or EMPs, are smaller than what the federal government even measures.
The recognized government approach to counting these EMPs is to count the ones that are over 5 microns. And again, as I mentioned, in this industry, that isn't the predominant exposure. It's to EMPs that are smaller than that.
Now Mandel and his researchers are planning further studies to learn whether these extremely small fibers are related to mesothelioma. For Stephanie Hemphill, I'm Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News on the Iron Range.
Mayo Clinic is dropping a complicated tax plan that relies on more than $500 million in state funds to make improvements to Rochester. The new plan would rely on a more direct contribution from the state to support the clinic's proposed expansion in southeastern Minnesota. It's a signal that House and Senate leaders are moving in the same direction when it comes to the subsidy for what the clinic calls the Destination Medical Center. Tom Scheck reports.
The Mayo Clinic has been pushing for a financing plan that would rely on a portion of future income, sales, property, and corporate taxes from Rochester to finance $585 million in public investments from the city. The improvements would support an expansion of the clinic's iconic Rochester campus. Clinic officials say the financing is a good deal for taxpayers because Mayo's expansion would deliver tens of thousands of new employees to Minnesota. But lawmakers balked at the idea, worrying it would set a bad precedent for state policy. After long discussions with leaders from the House, Senate, and governor's office, the Mayo Clinic is now dropping the plan. DFL Senator Rod Skoy says the new plan will rely on a more direct state subsidy to Rochester. He says it's comparable to past aid payments that helped cities deal with an influx of people who didn't live there.
I can view this as a comparable thing. You've got all these people coming in to utilize this, you know, high-quality health care at Mayo, and the city's going to need some help dealing with that infrastructure.
Skoy says the state money would be directly linked to the amount of money Mayo spends on the expansion. The clinic is promising to invest $3 billion over 20 years to expand in Rochester, but only if the state funds the public improvements. The state money would pay for roads, bridges, parking, and other amenities like shopping centers and entertainment districts. Carl Oestreich with the Mayo Clinic says he's pleased the legislature is moving closer to a compromise.
We knew that it was going to change as it went through the process. I think the good thing is that it is moving forward, and it's, you know, we've been listening to folks, and it's a solution that, you know, people are comfortable with.
The specifics of the plan are expected to be flushed out in greater detail in a Senate committee hearing today, but there's no guarantee it's locked down. DFL House Tax Chair Ann Lincheski says the House and Senate are now moving in the same direction regarding financing, but she hinted at differences. She says they include which entity oversees the financing, how much Rochester contributes, and when the public funding starts kicking in.
We have those parameters and the concept of, you know, the state providing some aid to an authority and then also a bigger contribution from the locals. So I think those are the similar parameters, but after that, the details are going to get, they're going to be different.
Lincheski says she'll release her plan when she unveils a larger tax bill early next week. That worries Republicans who support helping the Mayo Clinic but don't like the other tax increases that will be in the larger bill. Republican Senator Carla Nelson of Rochester said Democrats should allow a standalone vote on the Mayo Clinic plan.
I don't think any bill should be held, any legacy bill like that should be held hostage in a partisan omnibus tax bill. It's not fair to Minnesotans. They certainly expect better of us than that.
Nelson may not get her wish. Senator Skoy and Representative Lincheski say there are a lot of tax provisions in the Mayo plan, and they have consistently said it will survive only if it's in the omnibus tax bill. Nelson and fellow Rochester Republican Senator Dave Senjum would not say whether they would vote against an omnibus tax bill that includes the Mayo plan. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News, at the Capitol.
Even though Governor Mark Dayton has dropped the idea, Democrats in the Minnesota Senate will push for an expansion of the state sales tax to clothing and many personal services, while also lowering the tax rate. The plan differs from the governor's original plan in some ways, but in others is very similar, Tim Pugmire reports.
The Senate DFL plan repeals the sales tax exemption on clothing and creates a new income tax credit that low-income filers can claim for their clothing purchases. Some of the personal services that would be subject to the sales tax for the first time include haircuts, spa services, tattoos, piercings, sports and dance instruction, cosmetic surgery, and personal shopping services. Electronically transferred digital books, music, and movies would also be taxed. City and county government purchases would be exempt from sales taxes. The sales tax rate would drop from 6.875% to 6%. DFL Senator Ann Rest of New Hope, the division chair, said she believes most Minnesotans are open to the proposed changes.
I am a prime example of somebody in the middle class. It's okay with me to pay a sales tax on my pedicure. You know, that's okay. It's okay to pay a sales tax on the tattoo I'm going to get on my neck.
Under the plan, businesses would lose a tax deduction for foreign operating corporation income. The corporate franchise tax rate would decrease, while the research and development tax credit would increase. There's also more money for angel investment credits. Governor Dayton took a lot of heat when he proposed applying the sales tax to business-to-business transactions, and he ended up dumping all of his sales tax plan last month. In the Senate plan, business-to-business transactions remain largely exempt, although warehousing and storage would be added to the list of tax services. Dayton spokesman Bob Hume said the governor is still not interested in doing anything with the sales tax, but Senator Rest remains hopeful.
We hope to convince the governor that we have a good balance.
The tax rate on cigarettes would increase 94 cents per pack, which mirrors the governor's proposal. The Senate also included the sports memorabilia and suite taxes that recently surfaced as potential financing backups for the new Vikings stadium. Rest said those provisions will get further attention in the coming weeks.
We want that on the table so that we can fully vet that. And we wanted people to know we were thinking about it. But that will come up much more in the full committee when the bill gets there.
Senate Democrats will release the remainder of their tax plan later this month. That measure is expected to include an income tax increase on top earners, which would provide most of the revenue DFLers plan to invest in public education and other budget priorities. Republican Senator Dave Thompson of Lakeville said Democrats are using big tax increases to grow government and nothing more.
Their program right now is let's engage in more 1960s-style liberalism, which is if you see a problem, throw more money at it. And I think the taxpayers are going to ask, what am I getting for that money, until we can eliminate the waste, until we can go through the budget and figure out if we're using the money as best we can, probably they shouldn't be asking for more.
A public hearing on the Senate plan is scheduled for Tuesday. Democrats in the House are planning to release their full tax bill proposal next week. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
This is the NPR News Update, available every day around noon, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Minneapolis Public Schools is working with teachers and parents to revise its behavior and discipline policy. Lori Ewan reports.
The goal is to reduce the rate of out-of-school suspensions, particularly for African Americans. Blacks make up about 3/4 of the students who have been dismissed from school for disciplinary reasons, yet they make up only about 40% of total enrollment. Superintendent Bernadia Johnson says making sure students are being treated equitably is a top priority for her.
There's a disproportionate number of students that are being suspended, and that happens to go along racial lines. If we're going to address the achievement gap and the opportunity gap for students, we have to make sure we're lifting the covers on every aspect of education.
Johnson says suspensions and achievement are directly tied because if you're not in class, you're not learning. In St. Paul, officials say revising their policies helped lower the suspension rates for students of color and kids in special ed. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
A former manager of prosthetics at the University of Minnesota Medical Center in Fairview pleaded guilty Thursday to stealing artificial limbs from the hospital and then selling them on eBay. Elizabeth DeWicke has more.
Peter Stazica of Coon Rapids pleaded guilty to one count of wire fraud. Prosecutors accused him of stealing more than $122,000 worth of prosthetics and supplies from February to August 2011 while he was prosthetics manager at the University of Minnesota Medical Center, Fairview. As manager, his duties included buying supplies and equipment, working with vendors, and advising patients about whether new prosthetic limbs were necessary. He also admitted that he asked patients for prosthetics they weren't using without telling them he'd sell them online. Court documents say Stazica sold more than 60 prosthetics and related supplies to approximately 40 buyers. A federal judge will sentence him at a later date. He faces up to 20 years in prison. Elizabeth Stawicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The State Department of Natural Resources says an environmental impact statement is not needed for a proposed Minntac mine extension near Mountain Iron. Rupa Shenoy reports.
U.S. Steel wants to extend the Minntac mine by more than 480 acres. That prompted the DNR to do what's called an environmental worksheet, which includes a 30-day public review period. DNR Environmental Review Supervisor Randall Doneen says the public raised concerns about the potential impact on water quality. Doneen says that issue can be addressed by other agencies, so he says the DNR decided a more exhaustive environmental impact statement wasn't needed.
We were confident in the ability of the regulatory authorities to address these issues around water quality and stream impacts and watershed alterations.
Doneen says U.S. Steel will now go through a formal permitting process. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency is changing its disaster response rules to allow Indian tribes to apply for disaster aid. Dan Gunderson has the story.
FEMA Deputy Administrator Beth Zimmerman says in the past, tribes could only request a disaster declaration through the state governor.
Now the tribes, through their chief elected official, can come straight in through FEMA to the president to request a disaster declaration. Some of them cross state lines, cross our FEMA regions, and now we're able to acknowledge the sovereignty and the federal-to-federal relationship that we do have with tribes.
The law change was included in the Superstorm Sandy aid package signed by the president earlier this year. FEMA is now consulting with the 566 federally recognized tribes to develop interim rules. This change includes the 11 Ojibwe and Dakota reservations in Minnesota. It will take 3 to 5 years to write new regulations for tribal governments. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
A survey of more than 1,300 crop farms in Minnesota shows they earned record income in 2012, Mark Stile reports.
The Joint University of Minnesota and Minsky analysis showed the farmers in the survey had a median net income of nearly $255,000 last year, up more than 70% from the year before. The University of Minnesota's Dale Nordquist says by far the most profitable crop for farmers was Minnesota's most popular grain.
Corn is king, there's no doubt about that.
Nordquist says most state farmers benefited from the drought. The dry weather boosted corn prices, but Minnesota farmers got just enough rain to harvest a good crop and cash in on the high prices. Dairy farm income climbed 12% last year. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
20 groups from around the state will launch projects to fight hunger. Julie Seipel has more.
The statewide coalition Hunger Free Minnesota has awarded nearly $400,000 in grants. One of those grants will go to Hennepin County Medical Center to expand its hospital food shelf to neighborhood clinics. HCMC pediatrician Diana Cutts started the food shelf program. She says it allows hospital staff to provide healthy food for families who need it.
As a physician, I want to be able to not just tell a family this is the way I believe you should be eating, but to be able to give them some ability to access those healthy foods, which they really may otherwise have very limited access to, and which makes my earlier effort of education rather meaningless.
Other grants went to the Minneapolis Public Schools to expand breakfast in the classroom and to the Emergency Food Shelf Network for a mobile food shelf. Julie Seipel, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Target plans to rename some shoes it sells because it used a word not pleasant for Spanish speakers. Martin Moylan reports.
The problem concerns footwear, described as orina flat sandals. Orina means urine in Spanish. A Target spokeswoman said the description was based on a Russian name for girls, meaning peace or peaceful. But the retailer will no longer use that name, given what it means in Spanish. The offending name has been removed from the sandals on Target's website, as well as any in-store signs. Last week, the retailer caught flack for how it described the color of some dresses for larger women. Target had characterized them as manatee gray, a description it has dropped. Other retailers have used the terms manatee gray and orina to describe items they sell. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And finally, a new movie about the Duluth-based band Low premieres tonight at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival. It follows the 20-year history of the band, led by Alan Sparhawk and Mimi Parker. The film is shot and directed by Philip Harder, who's been making videos and short films with Low throughout their career. Morning Edition producer Jim Bickle discussed the movie with Harder, and he prepared this report.
Many people seem to want to call it a documentary, and that's incorrect. This is more of a document. There's a short introduction that we put into the film that starts to explain our relationship, and that's about as documentary as it gets. And once that goes, we just roll all these images that we've created over 20 years.
It sounds like it's more than a collection of music videos then. What sort of ties it all together?
Well, I think what ties it together is the fact that I don't know any other band who's worked with the same director for that long. And we've started to realize, well, the story is actually not only the history of Low, you actually watch them get older year after year after year, but it's also the relationship between Low as musicians and myself as a filmmaker. And it's not like we intended to do this. We just started working, and 20 years later, we said, it's time. Let's put it out.
I see in the trailer you talk about, I think it was the first video where you shot it on, was it on Lake Superior? And it sounds like that was a kind of a bit of a grueling shoot. Somebody got a concussion.
Yeah, I'm surprised they actually worked with me after the first three videos. Al slipped on the ice and knocked himself out. It was 30 below zero. They came up with this idea in minimalist, low fashion. We just want to push a boat around on frozen Lake Superior. That's where they're from, of course. And I thought, yeah, you know your music. And I use a very strange-looking film. It was a titling film. It's super grainy and bizarre, and the wind's blowing, and you can just tell it's so cold. My camera was freezing up. The cold, I think, shocked the film. And in the end, I thought it was a disaster, but when I put it all together and just slowed down the edit, it became a one-of-a-kind look, I think. And it sort of defined who Low were at that point.
3 inches above the floor, man in the box wants to burn my soul, and I'm tired.
Early on, Low was known for quiet, contemplative songs like this one. But Harder says after 9/11, the band's sound began to change, starting with a song called Canada.
That song was the first loud song they ever recorded. And Alan, he said, you know, I want to make a video where it's like the clown car. How many clowns can come out of a car? And I thought, that's great. So we set it at the border crossing of Canada and the United States. They're going into Canada.
Good afternoon. What brings you to Canada?
We're a band. We're going to
musicians, eh?
Yeah.
Well, you can pull your vehicle up right over there and wait for further instructions.
The videos we released started getting more violent, more political as well, and some were so, the subject matter just couldn't be released, so I just sort of put them on the shelf and brought it out for this movie. And then all the way to 2013 with a new video we just shot, Just Make It Stop, it seems like Low's gone right back to their roots and they've turned way down again. And it's interesting to see that progression of 20 years. And the film, you actually watch that. You see a young band, quiet, they turn up, they get more violent, the images follow suit, and they end up back to where they began 20 years later.
If I could just make it stop, I could tell the whole world to get out of the way. If I could just make it stop, if I could just make it stop, breaking my to the edge, I'm at the end of my rope. The rope is starting to thread. I'm trying to keep my hold. You say I'm something I'm not, but I'm not what I seem. Get my back off the wall. If I can just make it stop, if I can just make it stop, tell the whole world to get out of the way. If I could just make it stop, if I could just make it stop, breaking my heart, get out of the way. If I could just make it stop.
10-foot hole. See nothing but blue sky shining on my soul. As I untie the cord and untwist the knot, we can get where we're going if I could just make it stop. If I could just make it stop, I could tell the whole world.
That's the NPR News Update for Friday, April 12th. I'm Perry Finelli. Thanks for listening.